Now will you open your Bibles at 1 Samuel chapter 20 and remind yourself that this is but a section of the story. A lot has happened. A lot of things have been established. A lot has still to happen. A lot has still to be accomplished. But in some ways, although it doesn't seem so on the surface, we're at the stage in the story of David, a stage that is really quite significant. And I'm beginning to think that it is at this stage of the story that there begins to be evident in David's life, and perhaps even in his personality, certain things that are going to prove a problem for the whole of his life and service. How then are we going to start to study this chapter? Few of us, Christians though we be, ever take enough time to consider the significance of our lives in relation to the purposes of God. Nor do we really take sufficient time to consider the various bits and pieces of our lives in relation to the unity or the whole of our life in relation to the purposes of God. And if we did, I think we would give considerably more thought than we do to where we fit in to the ongoing purposes of God. You see, if we don't answer that question in some measure at least, we will be dogged by a sense or a feeling of irrelevance. Now that's a very difficult thing to live with. If you once begin to feel you're no use, that you've no real function, that you wouldn't be missed, I think you're at the stage of the beginning of a very real spiritual demoralization. And we must give more thought to where we fit into the purposes of God. I think we have to learn to give considerably more thought, no matter what our age may be, to what we are being prepared for in relation to the purposes of God. And consequently, I think we shall give considerably more attention to the question, why life is what it is. Why should things be with us as they in fact are? Now these are all very, very important questions. And following on from them, I think we would begin to give very careful attention to the developments in and the movements of the situations that we find ourselves in at any particular point in our life, in order that we will make sure that we are marching with God and not away from God, that we are walking and working in harmony with God and not at cross purposes with God. And I think we begin to see this element of confusion and uncertainty becoming manifest in the life of David at this particular point. This is why I've underlined in my Bible the word fled in the very first verse of the chapter. Now I really believe that there's an intensity there. I believe there is a pressure there. And as I go on through the chapter and as I think forward in my own mind to the rest of the story of David, I begin to feel that it is somewhere round about this stage in David's life that this man of God, marked out for such significant service, begins to be confused. He begins, we'll see a number of illustrations of this over the next sequence of weeks. he begins to be the kind of man who is impelled into action by sudden surges of emotion. And we shall discover that time and time and time again, he ended himself up in very difficult, very embarrassing, very painful, and very humiliating circumstances that did not need to have happened. In measure, the moment we begin to read here that David fled from Naioth and Ramah, and when we go on to find David saying that he feels he's only a step away from death, and when we go on to find David and Jonathan two saintly men, I think we've got to describe them as such. When we find these two saintly men hatching schemes of deceit in order to solve difficult situations in relation to the work of God, then we are doing something that is the complete opposite of what we were hearing last night in our Bible study about walking in the light. This is deceit. This is scheming. This is manipulation. And I think this is the stage of the story of David that we have reached. On one level, we've got to acknowledge that there seems to be, apart from his military exploits, there seems to be little sign of success for David. He seems to be increasingly in trouble and in danger. And if in actual fact he was the Lord's anointed, and he was, for he'd been anointed by Samuel, where was the evidence? David was in a hurry. Now you see, God is never in a hurry. And one of the deep lessons of faith is that we must learn to wait upon God. We are the ones who get agitated. We are the ones who feel that things are not moving quick. We are the ones who go in for the technique of striking while the iron is hot. That's not God's method. But if you consider the story carefully, the truth is that there are plenty of evidences of the hand of God upon David, evidences for those with eyes to see. Not least, what we saw, and I think this was a very important lesson, what we saw last Sunday evening in our study of the previous chapter, where we had a magnificent illustration of the sovereign power of the living God by the Holy Spirit to subdue instantly and repeatedly the intentions of wicked men. Remember, Saul sent a batch of soldiers to arrest David, and the power of the Holy Spirit stopped them in their tracks. And he did it a second time, and he did it a third time. And then Saul himself, in all the deliberate passion of his mind and heart, went to do the thing that all his servants had failed to do. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul. As we said last Sunday evening, he prophesied, he spoke in tongues, he manifested a whole range of apparently spiritual manifestations. But left him absolutely the same man, wicked, unbelieving, rebellious against God. But whenever these wicked men came near to David, they were stopped in their tracks. And I think there's a very great lesson here that we've all got to learn. And it is this. When the pressures of evil in many, many different forms come upon us, instead of giving way to panic, which we all do far too often, we must quite deliberately look to God. Oh, you say, that's very simple, yes. It's also very obvious. Why do we so seldom do it? We must look to God, and we must appeal to God. I'm thinking of the chapter in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 4, when in a situation of persecution, what did the saints of the apostolic church do? They gathered together in their normal place for prayer, and they said, Lord, Thou art God. Look upon this situation. It's altogether out of our hands. It's altogether beyond us in its dimension, its power, and its danger. But they looked to God. I'm thinking also of the situation in the story of Elisha the prophet in 2 Kings chapter 6, where the young man, the servant of the prophet, panicked because he became aware of the massive powers of evil ranged against the prophet and his work. And the young man was in a state of panic. And the prophet prayed and said, Oh God, open the young man's eyes. And God opened the young man's eyes, and behold, round about the prophet, the chariots and horsemen of fire. Next time one of these awful fire engines go clattering along Kelvin Hall Street in the middle of the sermon, disrupting everything, instead of being annoyed with the fire engines, think of the fire of God, the chariots and the horsemen of fire, round about. Every situation that belongs to God. Now, my friends, you belong to God. I'm assuming that tonight. You go out in the will of God to your work tomorrow, whatever that may be, wherever it will take you. Some of you may already know some of the problems that you're going to face. Some of you may be rather fearful of the problems. Some of you may be quite blasé and feel that there are going to be no problems to you, for you, and tomorrow morning by about 10 o'clock in the middle of the forenoon, you may find that your whole world is almost collapsing. Now, if this kind of thing happens, or whatever happens, remember that the work of God and the people of God are in the protection of God. And that's the beginning of peace. But we must go on from there in the context of the story, because these marvelous assurances do not in any sense eliminate the working of evil. David was God's man. David was in God's hand. David's work was in God's hand. The whole future for David was in God's hand. But there was still Saul. There were still the workings of evil. And the working of evil, to my mind, seem to come on three different levels, essentially. There is that level that Peter speaks about in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 8. Your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion. Oh, how frightening he can sound. I very nearly said, oh, how frightening he can be. He can't really be frightening because the devil is weak. He can sound frightening. The devil is a roaring lion. Great, sudden, ferocious outbursts of evil. Huge attacks, vicious attacks. I wonder how many people here tonight know something about that. When in unexpected moments, it seems as if the very roaring of hell is in your ears and in your mind and in your heart. It's very frightening. You have it in our story with that dreadful man Saul and his spear. Think of what it must have meant to live in that man's house. And then all of a sudden just the spear, just like that. Your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion. The second level, I think, on which the devil attacks or works is in terms of what Paul speaks of in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 14, as an angel of light. The devil presenting himself in an immensely attractive way that seems so supremely spiritual. That's the story of the Garden of Eden. That was the story of the church in Corinth. But the people of God were deceived. Now I believe this is a very, very dangerous level. As I said so often, I don't think the devil's technique at this stage in our generation is that of the roaring lion. I believe it is much more as an angel of light. And you see gleams of this in the story of David and Saul, because there are times when Saul seems immensely spiritual. There are times when Saul speaks that you really feel, oh, he's converted at last. He wasn't. The third level on which the devil seems to operate is that spoken of by Jesus in the parables of the kingdom in Matthew chapter 13, the parable of the tares and the wheat. And those who know about these things tell me that in the early stages of growth, it's virtually impossible to distinguish between tares and wheat. And that, to my mind, always speaks of the devil's technique of introducing confusion into the work of the kingdom. Introducing confusion by means of things that look like the real thing. And which look like the real thing for quite a while. But which in the long term become evident as having no part in the kingdom. They are tares, not wheat. They are distractions and they are contradictions. They are not the real thing. I've always been deeply moved by the words of the master of the field when he said, "Let both grow together until the harvest." And that's a word of tremendous assurance to every minister and every missionary and every Christian worker. The presence of tares will not harm the final harvest. Let both grow together until the harvest. Now all this is very important on a variety of different levels, not only in relation to David and our study of his life and service, but also with regard to our own day and generation. David was ordained by God and anointed by Samuel, the prophet of God, to lead the people of God. Now, whether David was aware of the extent of his commission, whether David was aware of the glorious service that lay ahead of him, is doubtful at this particular stage. Apart from his military exploits, there were no signs of his acceptance by the people. We'll read very shortly in our Sunday evening studies of David eventually fleeing from the court of Saul, and he gathered to himself over a spell of time a matter of a mere 500 men. Peanuts compared to the great mighty armed host of Saul the king. There were no signs of his acceptance in any sense as king or leader or ruler. And at this stage in David's life, although now it is quite a number of years since he was ordained by Samuel the prophet, at this stage he seems to have very, very little freedom to act. And up to this stage, even though his life was often in danger, he did not precipitate action. And even though we have emphasized here at the beginning of the chapter that he fled from Naioth, where did he flee to? He went right back to the court of Saul, the man who was determined to murder him. And so we find David back in the court of Saul, hemmed in by circumstances that seemed to have no contribution to the furtherance of the work of God. Now, I've heard people raising the question and saying, why did David not clear out sooner and start up on his own? That would have been sin. That is the kind of thinking in our own day and generation, the kind of thinking of people who believe or who seem to believe that secession, that is, cutting yourself adrift from the main body of the Church of Christ and setting up on your own, that secession and division are always good things. And my friends, I counsel you to read church history. Not least the church history of Scotland from the great disruption in 1843. Oh, you say that was on spiritual, yes, it was on spiritual issues. There came a point when there was nothing other for these men to do than come out of the church or deny their Lord. But if you read church history, you will be aware of the fact that they fought against it. They did everything in their power not to have to do it. Oh, well, you say it was done and it was blessed. Yes. That was 1843. In 1859, there was the second evangelical awakening that transformed not only the spiritual but the social life of Scotland. Mind you, before 1843, there were the Murray McChains and the Andrew Bonners. So the revival didn't start in 1859 or 1843. It started even before that. But I want you to think of the church history of Scotland since 1843. And what do you find? You find that in that great breakaway movement, it wasn't all that long before that movement split. And both of these divisions split. And they again split and split and split and split. And it's going on in this day and generation. And some of the most recent divisions and setting up of Christian work on their own have already split. That's why David didn't clear out sooner. And one of the great tragedies of the past 50 years of church history is to become aware of the fact that Scotland is littered with the remains of breakaway groups. And Scotland is marked up and down its length and breadth by the ruins of spiritual works that collapsed. Because the men and women who should have been the lifeblood of these congregations wandered off to more attractive pastures. I wonder what Andrew Bonner would think if he knew, perhaps he does know, if he knew that his church was built, aye, in a time of spiritual awakening. If Andrew Bonner knew that his church was likely to be sold to the Freemasons. Why should this be? It is because men and women have not learned the first basic lesson of Christian life and service. The lesson of loyalty. Now let it be said, and let it be said clearly, if you're a member of this congregation, you are expected to give it first priority in all your activities. If this is where God has constrained you and compelled you to be, if this is the place where God has blessed you richly, then this is the place that must have your love and your loyalty, so that what God purposed when he first laid his hand upon this place might be fulfilled. Faith and obedience and loyalty and long-term vision are of the essence of Christian life and service in this day and generation. Oh, I believe there were many people who tempted David to clear out. I believe many people that David, there's no future for you here. This is not where you should be. You should have cleared out long. There's this and there's that. You go there and so on. So they'll come with you, and you could do this, you could do that, you could do the other. I think it's great to see how David stayed where he was. I'm not prepared to pass judgment and say whether or not he should have moved at this stage. But I will say that I'm concerned in this chapter to see God's man dealing on the basis of deceit. Oh, you say it was a different... Yes, it was a different generation. Standards were different. Yes. Were the Ten Commandments different then from now? Thou shalt not bear false witness. What did David do? What did Jonathan do? Oh, my friends, I think we've a lot to learn here about the working of the devil. I believe we have a great deal to learn with regard to grasping the significance of the long-term strategy of God. I mentioned to you last week, I think, that I was speaking to a company of ministers of the United Free Church, and we were talking about apostolic evangelism, and I was seeking to emphasize to them something of the absolutely fundamental nature of taking a long-term view of the work. And I asked them to turn up with me. I think we just referred to it. You know the passage. It's in Acts chapter 16 at verse 6, the beginning of the second missionary journey of Paul. And you read there some of the most astonishing words that you'll read anywhere in the Bible. These godly, evangelical, apostolic missionaries of the cross of Jesus Christ. And they were forbidden by the Holy Ghost to speak the word in Asia. Isn't that astonishing? That God should forbid the preaching of the gospel? And when we speak like this, the question arises, as it arises in many other areas. The question arises, what about the people who needed to hear the gospel? What about the people who needed to be converted? What about the people who had no other opportunity to hear the gospel? The answer to that is in your theology, if you're willing to live by your theology. Did not Jesus say, all that the Father gives me shall come to me? Do you believe that? I believe that. And this is why, taking the story of David and relating it to that missionary journey of Paul's, and he being forbidden by the Holy Spirit in two different areas, big areas of needy darkness, being forbidden by God to preach. The first lesson is this: never mortgage the long-term work of the gospel for the sake of immediate results. And the second lesson in all of Christian work: watch out for the devil, who promises you, as he did promise Jesus in the temptation in the wilderness, the devil will promise you worlds of success if you will go his way. Now, I've no doubt at all that what God is doing in this day and generation is a work that is long term. I'm burdened in my heart on Sunday mornings when I see the bairns going out to their Sunday school class, and I wonder what pressures, what demands, what persecutions will come upon them. Oh, the difficulties that we've known, those of us who have been on the road a long time, the difficulties that we have known, I believe, are going to be nothing compared to what they will have to face. And I was saying last night at the prayer meeting, I'm equally burdened about all the young men going into the ministry. And I don't know that we've even begun to pray in earnest for them. Have we any idea what we are asking of them? That they should stand as the prophets of God in the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years? Years that could be marked by cataclysm of evil. Years that could be marked by an almost total departure from the faith. Oh, you say, Mr. Philip, if we've to stand alone, we've to stand alone. Yes, you're prepared to say that. If you're prepared to stand alone where you are, in your home and your social circle and in your work and in your places of recreation, are you prepared to stand for what you believe God has called you to do? Costly. I'm thinking the words of Martin Luther, "Here I stand, I can do no other, so help me God." There are many, many, many things operating these days, I'm aware of it, that would seek to take me away from what I believe God has commanded me to do. And if you ever pray for your minister, and I know that you do, then pray that he will be kept faithful, even if he stands alone. I mean that. It is long-term work, and it is time-consuming work that is evident at this stage of the story of Saul and David. And it would appear in the story that Saul, the wicked man, is still calling the tune. And so we have in our chapter, and we must just tie up all the threads now, we have in the chapter David back at the court of Saul. Now, some of the critical commentaries, oh no, this chapter's obviously not in the right place, because how could David have gone back to the court of Saul after all the things that had happened? Well, he's back. Was it wise? Could it have been otherwise? What was the alternative? I don't think there were any other alternatives. Oh, I think David could have hived off at this stage and gathered a little company of people and set up a little kingdom of their own and shut themselves off from the world and felt, we are the ones, we are the people, we are faithful, we are this, we are that, we are the other. But David's place was right at the heart of the world situation. I think it was reasonable for David to go back. And I think if we had been in his position, we would have done the same. Firstly, because Saul's outbursts of evil had been spasmodic and had always given way to sweet reasonableness that was most reassuring. So much so that Jonathan says, David, calm down. David, you've got it all out of proportion. Now, you see, Jonathan believed this. Secondly, Saul himself had more than once known the subduing power of God. Well, had he not spoken and prophesied like the prophets? Were there not grounds for believing that Saul at long last had been won over? But there's a third point here. That's a very practical one in Christian life and service. Lack of constancy is always significant. Blowing cold and hot, time about, is not a good sign spiritually. Oh, when I come across people who at times they're impossibly dedicated to God, and at other times they're like cold fish, I feel now there's something wrong here. And the fourth point is that the true nature of Saul and of the situation becomes evident only as time goes on. Now you say you've criticized David for his deceit. What should he have done? I don't know. Should he have given Saul the benefit of the doubt? Well, he seems to have done by going back to the court. I want you to note what is happening. I bring you again to that first verse of the chapter without any apology. David fled. I want us to learn spiritual principles. David fled. Now, I've no doubt at all here that David feels himself under pressure. Well, you say, Mr. Philip, what do you do when you're under pressure? Stay still. If you're under pressure, you're in no condition to be making decisions. He was under pressure. That's why he fled. He was becoming very aware of the power of evil and the designs of evil against his life. That's what made him fly away. He was very deeply grieved by the sense of injustice. Why should he be like this? Oh, my friends, we mustn't allow ourselves to be too upset by anything. It seems here in the story that David saw more clearly than Jonathan the danger of the situation. But on the other hand, Jonathan seems to have seen far more clearly the sure success of God. That seems to be what Jonathan's speaking about in verses 12 to 17. Now the time came when David could hold together the danger of the situation and the sure success of God and be completely at peace. And it was then, I think, that he wrote the 23rd Psalm. Thou preparest table for me at a banqueting table in the presence of my enemies. And God, having prepared the banqueting table, David sat down with his friends and enjoyed the party immensely, not forgetting his enemies and not forgetting the sure success of God. But that's David in the 23rd Psalm. That's not David here in chapter 20. Notice the description. Here, he is restless. Now, I know that when I'm restless, I've got to look around for the devil. He was anxious. He was distressed. Oh, you say, but that was natural. Yes. But we have to recognize that restlessness and anxiety and distress can be very dangerous, in that impelled by fear or by feelings of fear, I think we know enough theology of the gospel not to fear the devil, but we still have feelings of fear, and the danger is that impelled by feelings of fear, you can go and do something which sets in motion a whole train of consequences. You know, the next few chapters of David's story make me very sad. Oh, I see this dear man in all sorts of humiliating circumstances that didn't need to have come. But you see here in David, this restlessness and this acting on the basis of feeling rather than faith. And we see in David here and also in Jonathan what we see in many of the great saints in the Old Testament. We see them resorting to deceit and to scheming and to lies. Look at it in verses 5 and 6. Is this something of what Paul refers to in Romans chapter 3, doing evil that good may come? Well, that's not a good thing. And dishonesty and deceit are never necessities in the outworking of God's purposes. I looked up my book of quotations to get this quotation. I couldn't remember where it was from. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. Walk in the light with God and with men. And when situations are beyond you, look to God. Don't scheme. Don't manipulate. Don't resort to deceit. But notice as we draw to a close, the quality of friendship that Jonathan gave to David. I've written down here in my notes, where would David have been without the loving loyalty of Jonathan? Jonathan never got headlines. It was always David who got the headlines. But without Jonathan, David would have had great difficulty in surviving these crises. And Jonathan and his love and his loyalty was a gift from God. To begin with, in the early verses of the chapter, the comfort that Jonathan gave to David was not enough, because it was not grounded in God. Jonathan said, look, David, I know my father well enough to say that you've no need to worry, but that was no comfort to David. And then there came the time when Jonathan looked away from his father to God. And there came the time for Jonathan that he had to take sides. There came a time for Jonathan for decision on which there would be no going back. And he says in verse 4, whatever you say, I will do for you. I don't know that he meant that if David asked him to do anything evil, he would do it. But you know, David did go on to ask Jonathan to take part in this plan of deceit. Maybe Jonathan should have said, no, David, this is not our way to deal with God's work. Let's wait upon God. Let's look to Him. It wasn't the first time that a friend, a stronger friend, because David ultimately was stronger than Jonathan, it's not the first time that a stronger friend has led a weaker and valued friend astray. But Jonathan said this to David, not just because of personal affection, but because he could see that David was God's man. And I don't think we can ever overemphasize the value of Jonathan's love and loyalty for David at this stage. They were friends in God, and they were friends for God. There is a friend that sticketh closer than a brother, says the book of Proverbs. Aye. And we'll come, when we come to chapter 23, to that great statement where it says that Jonathan strengthened David's hand in the Lord. Oh, what a test of friendship. Oh, would God that all friendships and all romances, as we said last Sunday evening, were on this basis. To be helpmeets, strengthening one another. Oh, my dear people, there are friendships operating that are weakening each other in relation to God and to his service. But we do not speak of that tonight as we close. I leave you with this thought of Jonathan. I'm thinking not only of Jonathan and his dedication, his devoted dedication to David. I'm thinking of great David's greater son, who said, if any man will be my disciple, let him take up his cross and follow me. And if any man hate not father, mother, brother, or sister, he cannot be my disciple. Oh, think of Jonathan. Here was the breach with his father. Here was the breach with his whole family. Here was the breach with his whole future career as a member of the royal household. Oh, have we any idea what it cost Jonathan when he said, whatever you say, I will do for you. Whatever the cost, I am your man. I turned over in my Bible to the end of the letter to the Romans, and I found there Paul speaking of two people, Priscilla and Aquila, and he says of them, they risked their necks for me. Oh my. Can anyone ever be worthy of such love and such loyalty? Well, you see, Jonathan saw by faith that the developing purposes of God. He saw this man, David, at the center of that purpose.